Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Connor. Today we are joined by Andrew Quilty to discuss his latest work, August in Kabul, America's Last Days in Afghanistan. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Connor.
Andrew, I'd love to hear a little bit about who you are and where you're from and how you came to write this book. What's your career trajectory a little bit?
Career trajectory, jeez. I've been taking photos for close to 20 years now. The first camera I had was given to me by an uncle, and I took that on a road trip around Australia with a couple of friends when I was like 20. And actually, that was in 2001, and my two aspects of my life kind of maybe spawned to a degree that year. I kind of enjoyed using the camera, taking very basic photos of, you know, my friends and my travels that year, and so that ended up with me studying photography and then going into it as a profession. And of course, 2001 was also the year of 9/11, and I was in a very bizarre, out of the way place on September 11, 2001. This tiny little pub in the middle of Queensland, like the closest town from there was like 100 kilometers away. What's that, like 60 miles or something? And so, you know, like I'm not alone in that day being a very pivotal moment for everyone. But it kind of, I don't know, a few things happened that ended up seeing me, well, obviously in Afghanistan, but when I really trace it back, how I ended up in Afghanistan, I kind of trace it back to that point. And I'm sure that was the point that a lot of people's journeys toward Afghanistan began. But it was just a very strange place for mine to begin. Before I ended up in Afghanistan, I studied photography, as I said, and then I worked as a photographer in newspapers in Sydney, and then outside the country. I moved to New York for a couple of years in 2012 and did a bit of work there. I covered, Hurricane Sandy? Hurricane Sandy? Yeah, there. And then someone asked me if I wanted to join them on a trip to Afghanistan, where they were going to write a story for an Australian magazine. And I just sort of jumped on board, didn't have any intention of staying long. And that was in 2013. And I ended up staying there till 2022. So that's the long and the short of it.
When did your interest for photography sort of turn towards more of the extreme aspects of the human experience, like, you know, the hurricane, Afghanistan? Was that in the beginning for you on your road trip, or did that kind of evolve into being that way?
That evolved a bit, probably probably with the help of the kind of people that I was hanging around with and looking up to as a photographer. I think it's quite common for photojournalists to point their camera towards people who are unfortunate or, you know, down on their luck or underrepresented or, you know, underdogs of one sort or another. So it was something I'd often used my camera for, but not to the extent that I did when I got to Afghanistan. I mean, for one thing, you know, the misfortune in a place like Afghanistan is on another level to that which it is certainly in Australia. And it takes place in a lot more visceral ways, a lot more visually, I guess. And it makes the camera an ideal means of recording it. You know, in those very spectacular, confronting, often violent scenes that, you know, most people are probably fairly familiar with from Afghanistan.
How was the process for you of transitioning from using photography of your as your means of sharing your experiences to the writing method? I mean, was it a challenge for you? I mean, how was that?
That kind of happened organically as well. It was actually, the transition for me from one to the other or to the point where they both became somewhat combined kind of happened through Instagram. I kind of shudder to admit, but, for me, I thought photos were a great way to capture the visual beauty and nature of Afghanistan and the very visceral visual aspects. But I also found that there was a lot going on that you couldn't capture in the frame that needed to be somehow brought into the context of it. And so I tried to do that with the captions in my that went along with my photos on Instagram. And there just seemed to be so much, you know, wherever you pointed a camera, there was so much history and context outside of the frames of the camera that I thought was integral to bolstering the story of what could be seen in the photo. So that sort of developed, and bit by bit, I started not only writing to accompany photos on Instagram, but in, you know, more sort of formal ways for stories, you know, published in newspapers, magazines, and online and things. And I suppose that really the moment where I thought, okay, I'm not just a photographer, but I'm a writer as well, or, you know, a bit of both, or a photojournalist, or whatever you call it, happened when at one point I had some photographs that were fairly significant in terms of my work there and in terms of the current, you know, the moment in history in Afghanistan, and I wasn't with a writer at the time, and I would often travel with a writer when I left Kabul to go out to the provinces. I'd do the photos, they'd do the writing. And on this occasion, I had the photos, but I didn't have a writer. So I was like, well, I guess it's up to me. And that I had a very good editor that I worked with at the time who was pretty hard on me, but who taught me a lot. She was, it would have been a lot easier for her to have just gone in and corrected all the flaws in my writing and have done it all herself. It would have been a lot quicker and a lot easier for her, but instead she went in and she pointed out where I needed to address certain aspects. and made suggestions, but she didn't do it for me. She made me do it. And I hated that process because I thought I just put all my energy into this first draft. I'm like, it can't possibly be any better. That's as good as I can give. And then I realized the job's only half done at that point. When she handed it back to me, just, you know, like marked up to hell, I was like, I can't possibly sit down to this again. I'm done. But sure enough, you know, I made myself do it, and the article was much better for it. And I worked with her on and off for the years that followed, and she was very she helped my writing a lot.
I think it was worth it because this book flows beautifully. It's a very coherent narrative and it pulls you in. And for the listeners who haven't yet picked up a copy, what exactly is this book? How did this come to be specifically?
So I'd been talking to the publisher, the Australian publisher who published this first, for about a year and a half about writing a book about Afghanistan. By that time, I'd been there for like 7 or 8 years, and they thought, okay, you know, this guy's done a bit of writing. He's Australian. They needed a book out of Afghanistan, and we're going back and forth and talking about what the topic could be. It never really landed on anything solid, and then it got to like midway through 2021, and it became very obvious that the Afghan government was going to. Actually, it wasn't that. It was when Biden at the time confirmed the date for the withdrawal was going to be late August that year. We thought, okay, this is what the book has to be about. It's very obvious. And then it was like within weeks, it was like, okay, well, so this book isn't just going to be about the US withdrawal now, because all these other things are converging, like the Taliban is converging on Kabul. It looks like the Afghan government is increasingly shaky in the absence of the Americans. And so, the story that would be told in the end evolved very quickly, and the stakes kind of escalated exponentially. And I mean, it got to one point where I was actually, when we were having these conversations, I was in Europe. I'd gone there for a wedding in the summer of that year in July, and things were just going downhill so quickly back in Afghanistan. And it got to the point where I had to make a decision. Am I going to go back and potentially, you know, most likely get stuck there, because the airport, it looked like the airport, or it was inevitable that the airport would close down once the Taliban got to within a certain proximity of Kabul. So definitely get stuck in Afghanistan, and then kind of cross your fingers. It was a roll of the dice whether it was going to be like a civil war type scenario where the Taliban would be outside shelling the city until the government and security forces gave in, or if the government and security forces just rolled over and let the Taliban walk in, at which point it was like, okay, survive the potential civil war, now you got to cross your fingers and survive the incoming Taliban. I guess that decision was up to me, but I could tell that the publisher and the editor, they were probably thinking, okay, well, this isn't going to be a book if he doesn't go back in. But if he does go back in, it's going to be more of a book than we bargained for. So in the end, it absolutely wasn't for the sake of writing a book that I went back in. Absolutely not. It was kind of just to be there with friends and colleagues and things, and let it go down with them together, and especially with the kind of people that couldn't leave. I couldn't have lived with myself if I watched that all go down from afar while, you know, friends and colleagues who didn't have the luxury of being able to leave, you know, endured it, and it wasn't as though I could have a huge impact on their experience of it or what happened, but I just felt like it was a solidarity thing that I needed to be there to go through it with them.
How much time in total have you spent there in Afghanistan?
I first arrived there in December 2013, and then I lived there. So it was like, I think it was 9 years all up. I left mid last year, almost 9 years.
What was the best part of living there, and what do you miss the most now that the regime has changed?
Oh, there are lots of things. I mean, the work side of it was something that I hadn't experienced before. Like I just found a fulfillment in my work that I hadn't experienced before. It didn't feel like work. It felt like I loved what I did. It was really challenging. It was exciting. Sorry, I don't know what's... Is that me or you?
No worries. I think it's you, but...
Yeah, I think it is too. I thought I'd... Router on, do not disturb. Let's try that. And it was, you know, it was, yeah, exciting and risky at times. And so that heightens the, not only the work experience, but also the experience of, you know, relationships and friendships and the day-to-day. I mean, you know, like, I think, yeah, made good friends, like going through, somewhat extreme situations with friends. I guess it's like sort of trauma bonding or whatever you call it. But it does heighten, heightens everything, you know, and even just that the, if those experiences never eventuate, the possibility that they might, or the threat of them, heightens everything in day-to-day life. So, you know, going up the street to buy your groceries is like, it's like, you know, a mini adventure. And but aside from that, I mean the country itself is just incredible, incredibly beautiful. As a photographer, I love the light in the place, like a sort of hazy, dusty light, and the when it was clean and clear, like that high mountain air, in Kabul, constantly surrounded by these huge, 15,000 foot mountain peaks, and the people, obviously. I think if it wasn't for the overall character of Afghans themselves, I don't think I would have spent as long as I did there. Like the warmth and hospitality and sense of humor is uncommon, I would say, in comparison to other places in the world I've been, particularly given everything they've endured at the hands of foreigners, you know, like it always, I was always quite shocked by that, how welcoming people would be, even despite, you know, a lot of the misfortune that has come as a result of foreign intervention there.
I guess, speaking of the people, would you mind going in a little bit into maybe the story of Nadia? I think that was maybe the story that captured me the most throughout your book, and how you came to learn her story and the part you played in it.
Mm. Yeah, Nadia. She's an incredible young woman. I first met Nadia a couple of days after the Taliban took control of Kabul. And those days were just like indescribable as far as the sort of intensity of the experience was. apart from everything that was going on in the real world in Kabul and the desperation and the, you know, no one was going to sleep. Everyone was just constantly working to either save themselves or to get themselves into the airport or to help others to get into the airport and out of Afghanistan. And so that was really intense. And the other equally intense thing was these bloody things. Phones were just like, I just hated picking up my phone because every time I picked it up, there's just like a roll of new cries for help from people I'd never met, never heard of. And I know people all over the world experience that as well. But that was something that I will, that really stays with me from that time. And so it was both that and then going out on the streets where people would come up to you and they would have their papers, their documents that attested to their involvement with the US embassy or US forces as an interpreter or whatever. And I'd say, you know, can you help me? And I mean, you know, like I had my hands full with a few Afghan friends who I was trying to help. I just didn't have capacity to do much more. But and so it was very hard, you know, having people constantly coming to you and knocking them back. Nadia, I met in one of these situations where I'd gone to the entrance to the French embassy where a few hundred people had gathered outside. A few hundred Afghans had gathered outside because they believed that there were more Afghans inside the French embassy who were going to be transported to the airport and out. And these people were waiting outside in the hope that they could get in and then to the airport. I went there to take some photos, and before I took a single photo, I think I got picked up by the Taliban, kind of... I wasn't detained. I wasn't allowed to go. And they, you know, wanted me to delete my photos and just hassled, harassed basically, and sat down until they could work out who I was and get rid of me. And while that was going on, unbeknownst to me, Nadia was in this group of people waiting to get in the embassy, and she was filming me getting harassed by these Talibs. And then once they finally let me go, I started walking back towards my motorcycle, which I'd parked a few hundred meters away. And on the way there, you know, people were coming up to me asking for help. And it was just like, got to the point where I had to be like kind of rude, like, you know, I can't help you. And then, so I finally got to my bike and got on and heard this little voice like, excuse me, sir. And I was like, oh God, what now? And I looked up and it was Nadia. And she said, oh, I saw what happened to you back there. I took a video of it. Do you want it? I was like, and I just couldn't believe at that point, like someone was offering something to me when for those previous few days, it had just been people were asking for help. And I was like, oh, wow, that's interesting. And I was like, oh, yeah, sure, send it to me. And I gave my number. And, yeah, she sent it to me. And that was that. And then it slowly transpired. She didn't tell me at that point of her circumstances or why she was waiting outside the embassy, why she was trying to leave the country, but that slowly became apparent. And the story of that is obviously in the book. But it wasn't even Nadia in the end who I think told me of how dire her circumstances were and the – like really imminent threat she was under. It was, I'm pretty sure it was one of her friends who had to tell me because I was just so inundated with everything else going on and I wasn't paying as much attention to Nadia as I wish I had been in hindsight. And yeah, as it turned out, she was in like under dire threat and yeah, like the, at that point, it got to a point where I, when I understood the level of risk she was under. It got to a point where I couldn't physically help her, and so I had to enlist the help of others. I shouldn't let on too much, spoiler the book, but she's an incredible woman, and that the way we met is very reflects the woman that I got to know as I did get to know her more down the track.
Yeah, it is an awesome story. It's just saying for the people listening, and it's worth checking out. I don't know if you want to get in at all to politics, but what are your thoughts on the Doha agreement and what went down in Afghanistan? I mean, what are your thoughts there?
I mean, the Doha agreement initially, like for about 30 seconds, I was like punching the air. I was like, oh, amazing. And so were the people around me. So were the Afghans around me. It was like the first little ray of hope that people had for that the war might end in nearly 20 years. As soon as the details of that agreement were made public, it became apparent pretty quickly that this was not, it wasn't the ray of hope that I had initially thought it was, and rather it was like you know, the US had signed its own death warrant there in Afghanistan, that they were really capitulating, they were handing a lot more over, a lot more to the Taliban than they were asking in return. And my sense, I don't know if it's provable at all, but my sense was that it was rushed through, and the American side conceded so much in order to get an agreement that would be able to be implemented in time, that Trump at the time would be able to benefit from it in the 2020 election. Which, I mean, in the end, he didn't win the election anyway. But it just seemed, I mean, in Afghanistan, a lot of people thought that it was that the Americans had basically changed sides and were now working with the Taliban. It was that, I mean, the extent to which it benefited the Taliban over the Afghan government, that the American, three American presidents at that point had supported for nearly 20 years, that that the idea that the Americans were actually now supporting the Taliban was like not that far-fetched. I mean, I don't believe they were, but it wasn't that far-fetched.
Were you surprised by any of the actions or reactions by higher ups in the Afghan government or generals at all?
The reaction to the Doha agreement?
No, rather the reactions that took place in August towards the end there.
Oh, I mean, I don't think you'll be surprised by anything when it comes to Afghanistan ever again now, but I mean, I found it disheartening and disappointing the way that the security forces just collapsed the way they did. But I think it was, had I been in their place, knowing how little support the Afghan security forces were getting from the government, how little cohesion there was between the security forces, and how little belief there was in the central government. I don't know. I mean, in hindsight, a lot of the soldiers who surrendered and got away with their lives, you know, I think you could say that they made the right choice when you saw how quickly the government folded in the end. Imagine having fought to the death for that government that just capitulated the way it did. That would have been very hard to have lived with for the survivors of those soldiers. And I think, you know, it's also, you know, obviously the blame, there's a lot of blame to go around, and I think a lot of it has to lie with the military infrastructure that was set up primarily under the American military that, you know, built the Afghan National Security Forces kind of in its own mold, you know, to rely on, you know, cutting edge logistical capabilities and air assets and systems that have taken, you know, hundreds of years to evolve, and trying to transpose those onto a, you know, a 15-year-old army and police force, and expecting it to, you know, grow out of the desert like that, and then pulling the cord when on all the support for those systems and logistics and aircraft at the 11th hour. I mean, they never really stood a chance, and that was kind of had been evidenced from about 2015 when it became apparent how reliant Afghan forces were on international air support. When I say international, I mean American air support, I suppose. But sorry, man, I don't know where that noise is coming from. For example, every time a provincial capital was overrun by the Taliban and that happened a few times in 2015, 16, maybe 17, I think it would have been unlikely that they would have been retaken without American air support and some of the ground support. The Afghan forces just didn't have the capacity yet, and they had been built to rely on air support, because every time they'd gone out on missions, they had had, you know, on serious missions, they'd had American air support, which is a huge morale booster. I've never been in the military, but I can imagine how assuring it would be to have aircraft circling around above you when you're on a dangerous mission, and in the space of, you know, a matter of months, to have that taken away. I know for a fact that it seriously affected the morale, and then the casualty numbers started going up, and then the effectiveness of the missions themselves started deteriorating, and it really cascaded. That there was a real snowballing effect of that. When that morale started to tumble, it was just, there was no way it could really be stopped.
Well, do you have any advice for what we can do now from the outside to help both those that managed to escape and those that didn't? And what are you doing personally, if I can ask?
To help people escape?
And to help people that have escaped out as well. Yeah.
Honestly, for the people who have escaped, I guess I'm still putting all my effort into people who haven't escaped yet. I think the ones who have, at least they are physically safe now. You know, some of them, the ones who have got residency or citizenship, or got their kids in school or whatever, or jobs. There are plenty of others who are waiting in third countries, just waiting basically. But for the ones who did successfully get out, I feel like, someone else can sort of take the load now. Whereas I'm still, there's a couple of people in the book, who are really, their life is, they're really teetering on the edge of, whether they'll get through the next day. So my efforts are with them for the time being. And there's been plenty of times where I've just thrown my hands up in the air because I don't know where else to turn. I feel like, I think the best way for, the only hope that, Afghans, certainly those who had anything to do with the military, have now are American service members who have not given up, because certainly in Australia there's very little. I feel like I've run that path kind of to death. I don't really have much hope left for getting any other Afghans that I know here. But there are enough American service people and some Australians actually who have connections with Americans who are just, it blows me away actually, how determined they are and how indefatigable they are in trying to help people. And I would have given up if it wasn't for them. Yeah. So I've been really impressed by that. And, I've been like seriously critical of the American military and the Australian military, but like there are some individuals amongst them and, a lot of individuals who are just, just pulling out all stops and are very, gives me a lot of, it somewhat relieves the bitter taste that was left in my mouth over how it all ended there in 2021.
This goes without saying, but the book here is obviously such a huge, I think it's a big inspiration to people both in Afghanistan, outside Afghanistan, and some of us that don't know anything about what's going on. And so that's an amazing contribution. And I really admire the fact that you're still working hard at doing anything you can to help out. But as far as, writing and photography, what do you have coming up next in your career?
So for the last 6 months, I have been going through, I did a rough count. I've been through about 320,000 photos from my time in Afghanistan. I've been going through all of them. I've been captioning all of them, like basically just getting everything sort of tidied up, for my, archive, and also putting a book of photos from my time in Afghanistan together, and that's going to come out in October in Australia and hopefully a little later in US and Europe.
Awesome. Looking forward to seeing it. Well, thank you so much, man, for your time and sharing your story with us. Appreciate it.
Pleasure, Connor. Thanks for having me, man. Thanks for taking an interest.